This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The World Bank and some of those kinds of institutions had sort of abandoned infrastructure. So African countries have really been excited to fill those infrastructure gaps, whether it be railways in Kenya or power plants across the continent.
That's Kevin Gallagher, director of the Boston University Global Development Policy Center, who says many African countries are happy to take part in China's Belt and Road Initiative. Details coming up also. U.S. President Joe Biden is heading to Israel for direct talks on the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And a Kenyan court has dismissed a case challenging the importation of genetically modified foods. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. President Joe Biden will travel to Israel and on to Jordan tomorrow to meet with both Israeli and Arab leadership as concerns increase that the raging Israeli-Hamas war could expand into a larger regional conflict. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA's White House Bureau Chief, is on the line to brief us more on the matter. Welcome to African News Tonight, Patsy. Okay, we'll be back to Patsy in a little while. Hello, can you hear me? So until we get Patsy, Gaza's health ministry says Israel is continuing strikes have killed at least 2,778 people and wounded more than 9,700 others. The airstrikes began after Gaza-based Hamas fighters broke through Israel's heavily fortified border, shooting, stabbing, and burning to death more than 1,400 civilians. Israel is deploying tens of thousands of troops to the border in preparation for a full-scale ground offensive. For more insight, VOA's Pauline Diho spoke with Dr. Edgar Gitua, an international relations security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi.
I think Israel, number one, has quickly recovered from what we would call, quote-unquote, their security lapse, their intelligence lapse. Israel has one goal in mind, from my view. They want to go in and make sure they make Gaza inhabitable for groups like Hamas. I think Israel has vowed never to allow such people to live in proximity to them and operate freely ever again. So their ground offensive and what they have been trying to do from the latest reports we've been watching is that they are trying to, number one, go and create and remove any place Hamas could call a stronghold, any bastion of refuge for the Hamas people. And two, I've seen them also trying to warn the civilians to try and vacate the region, because there's going to be a ground offensive and they do not want to have collateral damage and all these issues that violate international humanitarian law, where we now have civilians in direct contact with armed forces.
How would you respond to some humanitarian agencies that have suggested, for example, that Israel is already committing war crimes against the Palestinian people? There's been a lot of bombardments. The entire Gaza landscape has been reduced to rubble.
I understand their dilemma. How do they selectively weed out Hamas from the Palestinian population? How do you flush them out? Because they have hidden among this population and they've been firing rockets at them day after day. So Israel as a nation state, there's something in international relations we call realism. It is a theory that states that countries will act in their best interest at all times, sometimes even superseding international humanitarian law. Because now Israel wants to secure its borders. It's dealing with its security. And unfortunately, some of these buildings have civilians who also reside there. So I will call the civilians collateral damage, in the sense that they've been caught between a war between Hamas a group that has been in their leadership for the past 15, 16 years, and Israel. So when you hear critics out there trying to condemn Israel, I want to take a different view. I will pose an opposing question and ask, then how best would they separate Hamas from the population?
Issue of Arab nations looking or trying to maybe use a softer diplomacy to engage Israel. But everything that was looking in the positive direction is no longer sustainable. I don't think anything that had been agreed to prior to this war is valid.
If Israel and Saudi Arabia had made peace and normalized their relationships, the security architecture of the Middle East would have changed. How? Saudi Arabia would have counted on Israel at its back to defend it, and vice versa. And who would have been the biggest loser? Iran would have been the biggest loser in the Middle East. The Iranian leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, denying that Iran had any part in what Hamas has done, even though we know that the Iranians have funded Hamas and Hezbollah for all these years. But in the same vein, when he said Iran is not involved, he applauded the Palestinians' warriors and said, "We salute you." In fact, to quote him, he said, "We kiss your foreheads." It's like he was congratulating them for what they did. The world is torn between. We have the Palestinians have people who are supporting their cause. The Israelis have people who are supporting their cause. And so the world is torn and the world is divided as to how to approach this issue.
That was Edgar Gitiwa, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, speaking with VOA's Pauline Ndiho. President Joe Biden will travel to Israel and on to Jordan tomorrow to meet with both Israel and Arab leadership as concerns increase that the raging Israeli-Hamas war could expand into a larger regional conflict. Patsy Widakoswara, VOA's White House Bureau Chief, is on the line to brief us more on the matter. Welcome to African News Tonight, Patsy.
I'm happy to be here with you.
So what message is President Biden sending with this trip?
So there are at least three goals with this trip. The first one is to show solidarity to Israel, to deter Israel's enemies, to further their attacks on Israel. Number two is, like you mentioned, to contain the conflict that has escalated since Hamas's attack 10 days ago. And he's also seeking to secure the safe passage of Americans trapped in Gaza and other hostages that are held by Hamas. And the last one is to ease the plight of Palestinians under Israeli siege. This includes the creation of a humanitarian corridor. So these are really, really big goals, and it will be done under a very short period of time. President Biden is scheduled to leave sometimes this late afternoon or evening for the direct flight to Tel Aviv, and then he will be there just in the morning and then continue to Amman, Jordan on the same day.
Biden's travel to Israel comes, as you said, as the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip grows more dire and as Israel prepares for a possible ground attack. Will that ground attack be coming?
Yeah, so we asked a White House official, a spokesperson for National Security Council, John Kirby, who briefed us last night on the trip. We did ask that question. Is the president's visit contingent upon Israel holding off its invasion to Gaza? And the response from the White House, the official response, is that the U.S. is not dictating any kind of military operational terms to Israel. But I think it's very clear that the ground invasion will not happen while Biden is there. It did not happen while Secretary Blinken is also in the region. So this is perhaps part of the calculation on the Israeli side. And of course, they also have other considerations, including tactical considerations, ensuring that any kind of ground invasion will not harm or will reduce harm to the hostages. So those are important concerns for them. But also, I think the other important part of the trip is that he will be meeting, President Biden will be meeting other leaders, Arab leaders, King Abdullah of Jordan, President Sisi of Egypt, and also Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, in part to secure those goals to contain the conflict as well as providing humanitarian corridor for the Gazans who are trying to save themselves and their family in the south of the Gaza area.
So will Egypt help out in the United States has been calling for aid to go into Gaza from Egypt?
Yeah, so this is a difficult situation, and no doubt President Biden is there to encourage or to pressure President Sisi of Egypt to open its border. I mean, if you look at the map of Israel, there's really only one potential humanitarian corridor, and that is the Rafah crossing on the south of the Gaza Strip. But there are, of course, considerations for Egypt to not open its border. Number one, security, right? I mean, they are, of course, concerned that Hamas fighters might infiltrate to the Egyptian border. And the other reason is that then what will happen to these up to over a million of Palestinians in Gaza if they come out of Gaza and into Egypt and become refugees? What guarantees will there be that they may return back to Gaza after the conflict has ended? So, you know, it's a huge humanitarian crisis and headache for the Egyptian government. And this is something that the U.S. has been trying to figure out with other Arab countries in the region of how to contain this conflict and also how to support humanitarian efforts that's undergoing there.
And lastly, Patsy, could Biden's presence be seen as a provocative move by Hamas's chief sponsor, Iran, or could it potentially be viewed as tone deaf by Arab nations as civilian casualties mount in Gaza?
I think the one main goal for Biden's trip in terms of the context that you have just laid out is as a deterrent, right? We have already seen the U.S. sending at least two aircraft strike carriers, and in addition to that, 2,000 more Marines and sailors have been sent to the region. So those are really strong military deterrents to show Iran as well as other potential, you know, actors in the region, whether it's Hezbollah or any other, you know, rogue actors and militant groups, that the United States is serious. They want to show the force that they have ready at hand in order to stop anything. You know, in the words of a White House official, is basically to stop anybody else from muddying the waters. But on top of that military deterrence capability that's being shown, the presence of an American president there is, of course, another big deterrent. So how Iran would react, of course, that's their own calculation, because, you know, even though we know that Iran has amassed all these proxies in the region, whether it's in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, there's a big question on whether Iran can afford to expend the considerable military leverage and resources to defend Hamas. So this is, of course, a lot of unknowns that we'll have to see in the weeks to follow.
VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wida-Kosuwara, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
China is hosting world leaders for a summit this week on a smaller and greener Belt and Road Initiative after 10 years of building big projects in other countries like power plants and railroads. Those projects have increased trade but have also heightened environmental concerns and left a number of African nations with big debts, as Kevin Gallagher, director of the Boston University Global Development Policy Center, who is at the BRI summit, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam.
Over the past decade, the Belt and Road Initiative has brought about $500 billion to emerging market and developing countries in general, and a big chunk of that has gone to Africa. And so it's added a whole bunch of new development finance, the $500 billion, which is all for developing countries. That's like adding a whole new World Bank to the developing world. So a huge amount of development finance, and it's been an infrastructure where the World Bank and some of those kinds of institutions had sort of abandoned infrastructure. So African countries have really been excited to fill those infrastructure gaps, whether it be railways in Kenya or power plants across the continent, that's caused significant amount of economic growth and laid a foundation for the whole century to create more interconnectivity across the continent. It's also brought some risks. The countries in Africa, as we've talked about before on the show, have been suffering from debt distress, not from anything that China's caused, but the region's been in significant debt distress. And so when you have some debt from China, that is also more difficult to pay back. infrastructure projects. They're somewhat endemic to conflicts with local communities, stress on the environment. And some of the power plants have been coal plants in places like Malawi and South Africa. Those are highly carbon intensive and may butt up against our ability to address climate change.
And what about those environmental concerns? Shouldn't the world be concerned about some of the environmental impacts of projects like power plants and railroads?
Yeah, well, China's done a bit of both. In the first part of the BRI, it was heavily coal-based. But in 2021 at the United Nations General Assembly, President Xi Jinping, realizing that this was no longer a viable alternative, said that the BRI would no longer finance coal plants around the world and that they would shift to low carbon finance, which is very welcome in the region. They've built some wind power in Ethiopia. They're actually manufacturing some solar in South Africa and are doing some work with critical minerals or transition minerals, as people call them. The key minerals of, say, cobalt in the Congo that can help be part of the electric vehicle revolution. So we're already starting to see a bit of a shift away from some of that real carbon intensive investment towards more cleaner investment, the kinds of things that the African leaders called out for at the African Climate Summit, investments in solar, wind, and transition materials.
Italy is the only Western country that is in the BRI, and then they're expected to pull out. Why is that?
Well, I think a lot of us in the West, a lot of actors in the West, don't see the BRI as a global development project. They see it as a geopolitical contest. And we're a development institute, and we look at it from, we evaluate it on its face value. And we look at case by case, and we see that there have been some significant benefits. Like I said, it's brought major economic growth to the developing world and major investments into infrastructure, which the West had largely abandoned. In Europe or in the United States or all over Africa, just over the past 3 months, we've just had so many climate events, and that the costs of inaction and the costs of not working together are much higher than sort of putting ourselves on two tracks. Let's have real conversations about the things that we disagree on, but let's realize that we have to work together, or at least in parallel, on things like filling global infrastructure gaps and addressing global climate change.
That's Kevin Gallagher, director of the Boston University Global Development Policy Center. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from the BRI Summit in Beijing. A Kenyan court has dismissed a case challenging the importation of genetically modified foods. Mohammed Yusuf looks at how the decision affects the regional trade and relations between Kenya and its neighbors.
The Law Society of Kenya, the nation's premier bar association that petitioned the court, argued that genetically modified food was unsafe for humans and that lifting a ban on its importation was unconstitutional. But in a decision handed down Thursday, High Court Justice Oscar Angote ruled that the petitioners failed to prove that such food was harmful for human consumption. Last October, the Kenyan government lifted a ban on the importation of genetically modified foods because of growing food insecurity and the failure of farmers to produce enough food to feed the population. Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, are produced using scientific methods, including recombinant DNA technology, which involves using enzymes and various laboratory techniques to manipulate and isolate DNA segments of interest. In animals, it requires reproductive cloning, making a genetic duplicate through somatic cell nuclear transfer. Judge Angote ruled there was no evidence to show that food can harm humans. Angote say there is a need for the population to trust the institutions set up to check the quality of food. There is some scepticism. Sidi Otieno is the national coordinator of Kenya Peasants League, a lobby group acting on behalf of peasant farmers. He says the country's regulatory bodies cannot be trusted.
What we are saying is that we cannot rely on the company's own assessment to tell us that the GMOs are fit, because when somebody is producing a good for profit and you tell them to attend the safety and take responsibility, then we are not sure. And in fact, in Kenya, for over 1 year, there was a product that was found in the shelves, Aromat. It was found in the shelves. It was being sold in Kenya from South Africa, yet it had GMOs. Yet the country has not allowed for GMOs. So we realize that we have a very weak regulation in Kenya.
Kenya's economy heavily relies on agriculture, which accounts for one-third of its GDP. Agriculture lobby groups have expressed concerns about the future of farming in the country, arguing that U.S. farmers using sophisticated technology in farms and government support of its farmers can kill Kenya's agriculture sector. Kenya's acceptance of GMO products has also worried its neighbors Tanzania and Uganda, who do not allow them in its soil. Tanzania said it will be vigilant against importing genetically modified food to its country. This African region has an agreement through the regional bloc, the East African Community, which allows the free flow of people and goods. Nasongo Muliro, a Kenyan international relations and diplomacy lecturer, says the importation of GMOs in the region threatens the trade relations between Kenya and its neighbors.
There will be a return to the non-tariff barriers, because now it will not be about customs, but it will be about standardization. And they'll be saying our relationship, for instance, with Tanzania will say, we may not even accept the cereals from Kenya because of fear of GMO, or they must grow through a thorough standard, which is not the case now because we encourage free trade. And that will bring friction.
Otieno of the Peasants League says the planting of GMO seeds can also bring legal battles among farmers in Kenya and its neighbours.
There was need even for the issue to be addressed in the East African Assembly so that the member states of these countries can be able to bring their views. Those are some of the issues that we are raising. Because if a farmer in Busia, Kenya, and a farmer in Busia border, how will they ensure that there's no cross-pollination? So how, if I'm in the border and I'm growing GMAs and somebody's in Uganda and it's not growing GMAs and there's cross-pollination? So we are exposing our people to companies so that they can be charged hefty penalties.
The lobby group said it also has challenged lifting the ban on GMO products and cultivation in the country, but their case is to be determined later this year, and they're hopeful the ban will continue. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
West African artist Amoako Boafo has a new exhibit of portraits in the western U.S. state of Colorado. VOA Scott Stern has the story.
The show at the Denver Art Museum includes more than 30 paintings by Ghanaian artist Amoako Boafo. Its title, Soul of Black Folks, comes from the writings of American civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois. Boafo grew up in Ghana, near where Du Bois is buried, and says the intensity of his subject's gaze comes from Du Bois' writing on double consciousness, the experience of black people looking at themselves simultaneously through their own view and through white people's points of view.
The engagement is always there because, you know, for me, there are ways of me expressing how I feel, what I want to say, by just connecting with images of people that kind of resonate or say the same thing that I want to say. So, you know, when you see the paintings looking straight back at you, that is the kind of engagement I want the characters to have, because it's me trying to express myself.
Boafo says the gaze is where everything starts, giving back the energy he's getting.
I try to find ways to see if I can put life into them. And, you know, if it happens, I'm happy.
Exhibit curator Larry Osemensa says Boafo's work is an assessment of black life through his lens, whether looking at friends or at people he admires, such as Jay-Z and Beyonce.
We want you to think about humanity, you know, think about the humanity of black people, think about the humanity that we all encompass and sometimes forget in the hustle and bustle of our daily life. And think about joy. You know, what does joy mean to you? What does it mean to express yourself, you know, your full self?
Boafo's process is part of the exhibit, with video of him starting with a pencil drawing, then applying paint, often with his fingers. He says he wanted to find a technique where people would feel they were in the studio with him, with all of the colors on the surface.
I did learn how to paint with the brush, and I enjoyed painting with the brush for a very long time, but then the feeling that I get from painting with the finger is way different from the brush, because the kind of freedom it allows me to have. It's also the kind of energy it gives, the way it allows me to move freely.
The exhibit runs through February. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Denver.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas,
Thanks for choosing The Voice of